the essay purpose. Sexaholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. There are no dues or fees for SA membership or self-supporting through our own contributions. SA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sexually sober and to help others achieve sexual sobriety.
Thank you, Larry. The content of this meeting tonight is going to be developed from an article that appeared in the June copy of SA called Relapse Prevention Plan, and there'll be copies up here for anyone who hasn't read it or care for that, for a copy of that. The concept is that we don't get on a slippery slope without a lot of preliminary things that we often have, that we always have, it seems to me, early warning signs. And if we pay attention and we respond with our program tools, we can avoid that slip. So, and one of the things that I always remark and react to when I read the white book, and particularly the personal story at the beginning of it, on page 15, the writer says, "Then one night, out of nowhere, a prostitute jumped into my car." Out of nowhere, you know? Out of nowhere. And my equivalent for that would be, I would say in the aftermath, I found myself in a bookstore. I found myself in a bookstore. Well, when I would be challenged, or when I challenged myself in the aftermath to look at that, there were always thoughts and feelings and actions that were preliminary. I didn't just find myself in a bookstore. And part of this concept of, staying off the slippery slope or catching ourselves as soon as we're on it is to examine that. So I thought I would take let me qualify myself first. I am Gary, I am a sexaholic. I've been in the program for 19 and a half years. My current sobriety date is March 12, 2003. So I qualify for the program, and I do not, I'm not proud to say I qualify for the topic matter too, because I've been on those slippery slopes and I haven't always succeeded. But I'm grateful to say that in the course of 19 and a half years, my life changed just dramatically from what it was before I came here. So I give God thanks for that. But taking a typical example of the behavior when I was in the worst throes of this addiction, and even with respect to some relapse experiences I had when I came in here, might be, in fact, looking at an instance when I would, quote, find myself in a bookstore. And this was very, very customary. If I look back, I can still, and this has been a good number of years, this is probably, well, it's certainly before my last sobriety date of March 12th, and a good deal before that. But if I looked at that kind of situation, what preceded it? Well, in the thought life, you know, it might be that I would feel that the work I was doing is just impossible, you know. My family is getting on my nerves. No one appreciates what I do. You know, I can just take a look. I'm not really going to do anything. All these kinds of thoughts were always there first. Now, if I was perceiving them as early warning signs, I've got a program. I can ask for help. I'm a very proud person. I'm very, and today it's still very difficult for me to literally ask for help. But when I see an early warning sign, when I start feeling or thinking those kinds of ways, today I'm much more apt to ask for help than I was when I was in the depths of this. So first there's the thought pattern. Usually the thought precedes everything, but sometimes it's the feeling. And the feelings might have been literally what we know as the halt. You know, feelings of hunger, I have a hard time admitting to a dual addiction in that respect, but the evidence is manifest. And in the depths of my sexual addiction, I would have feelings of hunger, and I would not want to go eat because I just couldn't imagine doing that again. So I'd find myself in a bookstore. And the same thing, I could get angry. Well, I would deny that I was ever angry. And I would never recognize it. But in my anger, I'd find myself in a bookstore. The same could be lonely. The same could be tired. The same could be boredom. The same could be self-pity. All of those feelings. Today, if I get those feelings, and I get some of those feelings, I get feelings of boredom, I get feelings of self-pity, but I've got a lot of names that I carry with me with their phone numbers all the time. And I call people today. And I work a program where every day I admit my powerlessness and know that I have to get through that day being sober. And when I have those tools, then I recognize I've gotten an early warning sign, especially like, say, the self-pity thing. I can get in that, and I have to catch myself on it. I have to deal with it, because if I just go into that and go into it for days, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. As a matter of fact, even when I came to this conference on the flight down here, I got to feeling really, this was unusual, I hadn't anticipated this, I got to feeling really sad. And I got to feeling, and it was a self-pity kind of sad, like, why am I having to go to Nashville? I'm only having to go to Nashville because of what I did. Why aren't I home with my family? You know, that I've never had that feeling until I started down this trip. And fortunately, I could have, with that feeling, I could have gone into isolation in this conference. I could have even not even shown up tonight, even though I'd taken on a responsibility and said, yeah, I'd do this. But thanks to a friend in the program, I spent over 2 hours just talking it through. And then I talked it through again later. And, you know, that feeling's not with me today. I'm thrilled to be with you, you know. I'm happy to be here. I know it took what it took for me to be where I am in my life today, and I'm grateful for that. So I didn't have to get on the slippery slope of a whole series of negative feelings that would cause me to isolate and then go to the next step. And then the other preliminary that should give me early warning signs is I'd find myself in a bookstore. Well, what do I mean I'd find myself in a bookstore? Usually the first thing is I'd get up from my desk at work because I was mad about something at work or overwhelmed or whatever, and I'd leave my office. Well, that's an action, and I got to look at that. When I first came into recovery, I'd been in treatment up in Minnesota. This was back in 1989. And that had been a problem in the past, this getting up and leaving my office, sort of an escape thing. I'll just go for a ride. But when I got out of treatment, and I had this very conscious awareness of this, one of the things that I did is I got myself a stuffed lion. And I'm a big man and a stuffed lion, you know. And I'm a professional man in a professional office. And I had that stuffed lion sitting on a bookcase right by my door. All my clients would see it when it came in. But I put my keys under there. So I couldn't leave because I'd have to have a dialogue with this lion about what's going on here. Now, I did that for a long time, but I haven't done it for a number of years. But I think I need to think about employing that in other respects, because it's a way of breaking into this cycle and thinking, acting, and feeling, so I recognize early what's going on, and I don't have to go down that slippery slope. So, and looking back, I know that I always had those signs available to me. So the challenge, and the challenge for today, is I don't have the same kinds of things. I don't leave my desk. I don't say, well, I'm just going for a drive. I mean, I've learned what that was all about. But back in the feeling realm, when I was talking about how I was coming down this flight, or other kinds of feelings, feeling overwhelmed or that kind of thing, I recognize those feelings, too, as blinking lights, warning signs, you know, not to get into that slope, not to do those kinds of things that would put me into deep trouble with this addiction. One last thing I want to share that's referred to in this article that sort of originated in our area and that we took from some ideas that we found in other places was the idea that when I see that I'm, well, this is what happened when I last lost my sobriety. You know, in this title we talk about relapse. We don't talk about slip. And that slip word, you know, gets thrown around a lot. And I heard that it's an acronym for sobriety lapse by planned or sobriety losing its priority. So those are things they got to pay attention to. But I last lost my, there it is again. I last relapsed with masturbation back March 11th. And I was really, I'd had good periods of sobriety before that of 2003. And I was really, just really down. I just was overwhelmed by it with anger at myself and that. And so one of the things that I employed at that time and that we'd used in our program over time with other people was putting myself in intensive care. And, you know, there's even another session today or tonight or now on the medical model of addiction. And so putting myself in intensive care was sort of the same kind of idea. And it would constitute or involve things like, first of all, asking a group of people, four or five people, including my sponsor, for help, and then going on paper, having a written plan, having worksheets like just a simple grid on one side that tells me the boundaries, the things I have to avoid and recognize as troublesome things. On the other side, positive sobriety actions. And I have to do these worksheets on a daily basis. I have to do a daily accounting of all my time, hour by hour by hour, and turn that in and deal with this committee and do that for like 30 days and then maybe extend it. But the idea is that whatever the challenge to me is or to other members, I think, of the fellowship, we don't have to go down that slippery slope. We have a program, you know. The fact that there are people I can call, that I can recognize the things that are going on, that I can ask God to come into my life, to come into that moment of temptation, it's just a blessing. And one last thing I just share about that last reference to asking God into my life. I was at one of these conferences in Baltimore, I think it was 1994, and in a group like this, the speaker said, and he was giving an example, if he was walking down the street and an attractive person came towards him who would trigger his lust and his desire to look, that he would say just two words, come in, which is that simple prayer asking God to come in right then, right there, right at that moment. And I picked that up, how many years ago? 14 years ago in one of these conferences, and it's a hugely valuable tool. And so I encourage you to think of what the tools are that you can use, what the early warning signs are that you can recognize so you don't have to get on that slippery slope and please God not descend further down it. Those are some thoughts I have on the subject. Larry's going to share with you, and then we'll have some time for open mic and your sharing. Thanks.
I'm Larry. I'm a sexaholic from Asheville, North Carolina. To give you some context, I'm 71 years old. And I began to become aware that I might be a sexaholic about 3 years ago. So I'm a very quick study. My principal form of acting out has been, at least in recent years, internet pornography with associated masturbation. And in early 2006, my wife walked in on me twice in a week, two times in 1 week, at the computer, viewing my favorite websites. And both times was, each time was followed by a lot of anger and ugly scenes. And I promised each time that I'd never do it again. And then, out of concern for her, not that I thought I was an addict, but just for her, I wouldn't do it anymore. And so a few months later, she walked in on me for the third time. third chorus, same song. Despairing of salvaging me, she packed up her horses, our dogs, most of what she owned, and went to Florida. And we live in North Carolina. I didn't know if she was coming back in the spring or ever, and I was very angry about that. I left out a step here. What happened after the third time that she caught me, she told me that she thought I was a sex addict, so we read all kinds of Carnes literature, sex addiction literature, And I was pretty sure that I had a problem, but I was not at all convinced that I was a sex addict. Because in the Carnes books, I shouldn't be mentioning those here, I guess, but there was a list of things that are the characteristics of sex addicts. And there were four or five of them that had nothing to do with me. So I figured, can't be me. But after a while, several months, my wife started to attend Essanon meetings, but I still wasn't going to any SA meetings. And after maybe a month or so of her going to those meetings, I really got scared that she was going to learn some stuff that I didn't know and be one up on me in this whole deal that we had. So I started to go to SA meetings. And I read lots of the program literature. After a few months, I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And with his generous help and time, I worked through steps 1 through 4. And it was about this time that my wife packed up everything and at 5 o'clock one December morning went to Florida. So now I was alone, and I didn't even have my dogs. I mean, this was really a desperate time. But I was going to meetings, and I was doing then maybe 3, sometimes 4 meetings a week. I was working the steps with my sponsor. And I put together a little over nine months of sobriety, and I was really very proud of myself. And I came home the evening of December 18th, 2007, met a friend, went out, had dinner with a friend, had 2 glasses of wine, came back home, turned on the computer, dialed up my favorite websites, binged for 3 or 4 hours, masturbated, and that was my relapse. And that's what happened. But then as I read this article and essay, it made me reflect on that a bit and ask what really happened. And what really happened was, first of all, there were 2 of the halt conditions present that evening. I was angry, and I was lonely. I was angry at my wife for leaving me. I was angry at myself for being in this situation. I was very resentful that my wife was failing, which is away, and failing to see all the wonderful progress I was making in recovery, so I could get some credit from her for that. And the final thing was I was feeling entitled. I had 9 months of sobriety, for God's sake. You know, I mean, you know, I'm entitled to a break, you know. And of course, entitlement's a tough thing to deal with. Because, you know, to me, entitlement is wanting something that I don't now have, or wanting not to have something that's being, happening to me. And when I'm feeling entitled, and particularly when I'm feeling entitlement in a denied sense, then resentment's the first thing that comes to my mind. And then acting out, and then shame and guilt, and then entitlement, and then resentment. And it's a vicious circle that I can get myself into. So it seemed then, that evening of December 18th, that it all happened like the prostitute getting into the car. There was really a lot that was going on before that. And I tried to jot some of these down. I had become complacent. I was feeling that I was in control. I wasn't even sure I was really an addict, though I'd done steps 1 through 4. I still wasn't quite buying that. And in fact, I am in one very perverse sense grateful for my relapse, because it was the relapse that proved to me that I was a sex addict. Because all the decades that I was acting out, I never tried to stop and failed to stop. I never tried to stop. So I didn't feel that I was compulsive about it. I was just doing what I wanted to do. And this was the first time that I was doing something that I didn't want to do. And so that was... But I had become complacent. Second, that evening, earlier on, when I was out to dinner with my friend, I had engaged in some flirting. There was a female server at our restaurant, and I wanted her to think I was, I'm 71, but I did want her to think that I was at least clever and maybe a little cute. So I was flirting with her earlier in that evening. I did have the feeling that I could handle this. I didn't need to call my sponsor. I didn't need to call anybody, any help. I can handle this was another thing that was at play with me. I certainly was playing the victim that evening. It was, you know, poor abandoned Larry that evening. I was blaming others, blaming my wife principally, taking credit for my own recovery. Program didn't get any credit. Higher power didn't get any credit. Sponsor didn't get any credit. I was taking credit myself. I was not making sobriety a priority. The way that was working then in my mind was getting my wife back was the priority. And if I were sober, maybe I could get her back. Instead of, if I get her back, maybe I can stay sober. If I stay sober, maybe I can get her back, is what it should have been. What it was the other way around. I didn't make sobriety the priority. Getting Sandy, my wife, back was the priority. So I acted out. And the next day, I called my sponsor and told him. A few days later, I had a meeting, and I fessed up in my group, my home group's meeting. And I reset my sobriety date to December 19, 2007. Just to bring the story home, my wife returned in May of 2008. We ended 21 months of abstinence at Christmas. Last week, I picked up my 1 year anniversary chip. So, thanks, guys. So now, when I get tempted, as occurs from week to week, even though I'm 71. I do four things. I get busy, first of all. I just do something. Not necessarily something that's program activity. Just do something. I call someone. I play it through. I think, if I do this, what is likely to follow? And then finally, I remember the pain of what had followed in the past. So that's my story. Thanks for listening.
So we're reminded, as it says in a vision for you, that we only know a little, but you know something we don't know. And we have an open mic now. If there's a lineup of people, just form a line here and share. In the interest of giving time for all who like to share, let's try to keep our shares to 3 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tanya. I'm a grateful recovering sexaholic.
Hi, Tanya.
And I've been in program for 4.5 years, and I have 2.5 years of sobriety, so I know a little something about relapse. One of the things that I learned is there's an analogy that's used, and that is you're trying to keep this ball on the top of the hill, and at the bottom of the hill is a pond, and you want to keep the ball out of the pond. And if you have the ball at the top of the hill, then you're safe. But the more it rolls down, the harder it is to catch the ball before it lands in the water. So the idea is to keep the ball at the top of the hill and not try to stop it when it's almost all the way into the water. And one of the things that I've done, I spent a little time in another S program, and one of the things that it was one where you set your own sobriety definition. What I found was the people who are having success in the program actually had stricter definitions of sobriety than what our definition was. They would, we would give our bottom lines at the meetings, and they would say things like, you know, my bottom lines are no sex with self, no sex with anyone other than my spouse, and then add, and no pornography, and no internet, and, you know, so on and so forth. So I learned from that, and the thing that I learned is If true sobriety includes progressive victory over lust, then our definition is a minimum bottom line, and I have to reinforce that if I'm going to stay sober. One of my main forms of acting out was chatting. I would get online, I would chat with guys, and then meet them for sex and that kind of thing. And so for me, chatting is losing my sobriety. Even if I just get on and say hi to a friend that I know out in the real world, if I do that, that is a loss of sobriety. And that, I think, has been one of the main things that has kept me sober, because I know that if I cross even that line, I have lost my sobriety, and I've lost 2.5 years of hard work. Well, I haven't lost it, but you know what I mean. It's, you know, I've, you know, thrown away something very precious. So for me, making the bottom line stricter than our definition has helped me a lot in maintaining a relapse-free sobriety, and that, and realizing that it's only one day at a time. You know, I only have today. However much time I have, I only have today. Thanks.
Thanks, Tanya.
Good evening. My name is Carlos. I'm a sexaholic, and for the last 14 months, my life has changed because of the SA program and the principles and the traditions, and for people like you all. And thank you all for being here. It's one of the things that I've realized about myself is that when it comes to work, I'm a sloth guy, sluggard, and I don't know if it's the idea that I for 41 years of my life, I've been dealing with this addiction. And after a two-week layoff, because I'm an instructor, and after a two-week layoff, about 4 or 5 days before school was going to crank up again, I was starting to get dreams, somewhat erotic dreams, and could not figure out what was going on. I said, there's something. And so that was one of my... Okay, there's a trigger going on. Something's going on. So when I finally realized it was the fear or the fact that, okay, am I going to be prepared to where I need to be for the rest of the semester? And by just thinking about it, well, that's not, there's no action in there. So realizing that this is my, one of my character defects, being a slugger, sloth. So how do you deal with that? Well, you prepare. So one of the things I'm doing, I'm really making a conscious effort to apply myself. And like when I was in the airplane over here, I've got my PowerPoints that I'm working on. In other words, the whole thing is that I'm doing the opposite of what a sloth would do. And that is I'm working hard at doing the things that I need to do to be where I need to be at work. And I need to be accountable for those people too, and not just at work, but also in the program. And I, because of the last 14 months, I've changed things, and it seems like this has been the total focus of it, which it needed to be, because without my sobriety, I'm not going to have a job, family, and those things. But you know, I think that's, I just wanted to share that because I'm not too sure if it has any pertinence, but I hope it does. But the thing is that, you know, this program is helping me become a better employee, as well as a dad and a husband and those kind of things. Thanks.
I'm Gina. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Gina.
Even though I use the term relapse occasionally, and we hear the word slip a lot, what I have come to think about these times when I've had to reset my sobriety dates. I've had 3 sobriety dates since I've been in this program seriously since January of 2006. Really what I have done is I have given my sobriety away because I've made a choice. And that's really important for me to understand, is I have a choice. And every time that I have a lust hit that comes toward me, I make a conscious choice of how I deal with that. And every choice that I make takes me in one of two ways. The action that I take will either be one of recovery or one of relapse. There is no middle road. There's a lot of gray areas, but that's not one of them. Every decision I make is either on the side of relapse or recovery. And when I realized that and started to own that and became willing to surrender that to God, then my life really changed, and I was able to stay sober one day at a time. And I know that as long as I keep doing that, and I did that by working the steps, You know, steps 1, 2, and 3 taught me to be able to trust God in a way that I've never trusted God in my life, even though I've had a relationship of some sort or another, whether I loved him or hated him, all my life. You know, but steps 1 through 3 taught me to trust God. And I can't surrender to something I don't trust. And I'm not going to surrender to something that I don't trust. So those are things that have made a really crucial difference and are the basis of my recovery today. And even though we do 10-step inventories, you know, I live my life in 1, 2, and 3. I can't, God can, so I think I'll let him. Because if I don't, then eventually, you know, I'm going to be far enough down the path that giving my sobriety away will no longer be a choice. It's just something I will have to do. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing.
Hello, I'm John H., a recovering sexaholic.
Hi, John.
I came into the program in New Year's Eve of 85 in Portland, Oregon, by the grace of God. This program found me after 27 years of acting out, basically misusing women, manipulating them. And I knuckled it for 22 months. I was in a foreign country and there was no program. I wasn't working the steps. I was reading the book, but I tried to start the program. Never worked. Well, it took me 6 years to realize that I was in a slippery place. From that time as I got into the program. And once I got out of the, when I left and made the decision to get some help, the relationships with women changed. I no longer was trying to manipulate them. And the more it grew. But the one thing that seems to be for me the underlying thing is self-hate. I go through step 4, go through step 8, 9, and review as it's peeled the onion. I begin to see what I didn't see, what I was acting out. Completely blind. You know, treating people as things and not even, you know, abusing them and myself as well, not even realizing that. So that self-hate was the bottom. And that's what I have now at times. You know, I'll hit my finger or I'll make a mistake and I'll call myself an SOB. Well, every time I do that, I'm making that line of that I'm no good get deeper and deeper and deeper. Somehow I have to change that and change to something else. God, I'm not junk, you know, or something that'll cancel that out. But it's almost automatic. If I do something, poof, you know, I want to judge somebody does something wrong. Why that SOB, you know? I have to pull that back because that's not a very endearing term, you know. So that is my struggle, is constantly to reflect. And I, you know, all those years, right now, from the mass, from acting out with myself, the sobriety date is June 12th of 97. You know, and those are encouragements to realize that I don't do that anymore. But that's because of the program. Because when I came home, I got into a rehab, and I started working the program and going to meetings. But prior to that, I was just flopping around like a fish out of water. You know, so really the program, you know, it just keeps us alert and going to meetings and hearing things, coming to conferences. Had my first conference in 1986 in Portland, Oregon, and I've been going more or less to them forever since. But it just takes time, you know. My graduation is like the Chinese torture method. You know, the drop at a time. Well, God, it's taken me 27, 28 years in order to be able to gradually come to an awareness of these different slips and be able to be humble enough to ask for help because I think I can do it myself and I can't. So thank you all for being your helps.
Thanks, John.
Good evening. My name is Dave, and I'm a sex addict.
Hi, Dave.
Um, one of the things that in the program I'm in Boone is a sponsor, when I did relapse, would always take me back to the first step. Because the question I always learned was this one of powerlessness. In other words, whenever I relapsed, the question would be, well, what is it about powerlessness that I didn't understand? And each time I realize something, I realize, or maybe put it another way, in the medical way that the big book uses, you know, what is it about that triggers the allergy, if you will, that I don't understand? Because each time I've done that, you know, I'd relapse, I'd go back and say, oh, that's what powerlessness means. I think of one time where, you know, and it's usually sometime I'm terrible, it's usually a place where I'm not respecting my addict, where I don't really think my addict is that powerful. I remember one time where I just had this thought in my head about, well, what if I check out this restroom? You know, I mean, I didn't, the restroom was never a place I had any sexual activity or anything. But just the fact that I believed I could, and I decided to say, yes, I'm going to go in there and look, all of a sudden I was a goner. Next thing I knew, I was acting out. So that was one thing that I learned in relapsing, is what is about powerlessness that I don't understand. The other thing that my sponsor helps me, he always tells me it's a gentle program, and he said, you know, he helps me, you know, yes, this is serious, yes, this is something I have to reset my sobriety day, but also learning to celebrate progress. You know, just because I relapse doesn't mean everything I did up until that time is all wasted or that I didn't learn anything. And, you know, the last time I think of, you know, I have this uncle, he sends me three things. He sends me political stories, sappy stories about God, and then adult jokes, you know. And there was one he sent me this image, and you know, I knew what I was doing, you know. The title had XXX in it. Well, I better go check that out just to make sure, you know. And I did it. It was this sophomore, stupid thing that, you know, I had to, you know, follow the plot and follow it to the end. It was everything I thought it would be. And I ended up acting out, masturbating. And right then I was triggered. I wanted to go on a drunken spree. I wanted to act out with someone else. Instead, I got to a meeting the next day. And yes, that was white chip. Yes, that was a relapse or slip or whatever you want to call it. But it was progress, because this time, yeah, it was something stupid, but it wasn't something that would get me my picture on the front page of the newspaper. I wasn't going to lose my job over it. I told my wife about the image my uncle told me. I wasn't going to lose my marriage. So yes, it was a relapse, but boy, there was a little progress to be celebrated there. So I guess those are the two things I saw for me, was understanding powerlessness, but also maybe seeing the things where I may have grown a bit. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Felix. I'm a sexaholic. And I'm heading for a relapse if I don't overcome my shame and I say what's in my head very loud. I'm a high school teacher. I'm from Spain, but I work in America. And 2 or 3 weeks ago, I pick up the phone. It's one of my female students getting sexual and romantic with me. I couldn't believe that. Wow. You know, I just hung up, you know, and called my sponsor. But my sponsor didn't pick up the phone. Then I called my boss. And I said, sir, this is happening to me. I just want you to know, because I don't want to have any kind of trouble with you. It is very dangerous, you know. But after this, this thought is still in my head. And I'm having sexual dreams. And I'm having fantasies about this. And when I'm not paying attention to my own thoughts, I'm figuring out the way I can have sex with this person, not getting caught, not getting sent to prison, you know. So I want to surrender this to you and to God, because I want to be sober one more day. That's all I have. Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you.
My name is Rob, and by the grace of God, I'm a grateful recovering sexaholic. The idea of a slippery slope, I guess the context that I put that in and I think about is where the Big Book talks about, you know, when we are in spiritually fit condition, we can go anywhere with God's purpose, and when we are not spiritually fit, you know, there's nowhere that I can go that's safe. And for me, this is just what occurred to me, is that I'm headed for relapse whenever I disconnect myself from reality, because my higher power is in reality, and if I'm not in reality with Him, there's no contact there, you know. And when I get expectations of things that aren't true, and when I get fears, and I live in those fears that aren't reality, and when I have resentments that aren't true, or even if they are true, if I live in my head with those, if I live in fantasy, I'm no longer connected with my higher power, and I'm ready for relapse, you know. And sometimes nothing happens around me that causes me to relapse, but any time I take that step away from my higher power, I've opened myself for relapse, you know. And so it just, that's, you know, and I was thinking about the counter to that, you know, is the answer that I call my sponsor, I call somebody, or I talk to somebody, or I go to a meeting. I find some way to ground myself in what is true and what is reality, because there's nothing I can do. I can't think my way out of my addiction. I can't outthink my addict. He's been here all my life, and he knows me. My higher power is the only way that I do that, and so I have to find a way to stay connected with Him. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mozzie. I'm a sexaholic. I've been introduced to a 12-step program 8 years ago. And with the help of God, I haven't been smoking or drinking for 8 years. And about 3 years ago, when I was masturbating a lot, somebody in AA told me that there is a program called SA. And I'm like, really? There is such a thing? And of course, at AA, I was told not to drink and I can't smoke. And so that was really difficult at the beginning, but with the help of God and the STEP program, I could do it. When I joined SA, they told me that I couldn't masturbate. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I can't drink, I can't smoke, I can't masturbate. I mean, I was introduced to masturbation when I was 7 years old. And I'm a product of sexual abuse, and so I was introduced to sex a long time before I was introduced to alcohol and drugs. So when I joined SA, I thought, I didn't know what I was getting involved with, and I thought, good. Well, I don't smoke, I don't drink anymore. Thanks God, I'm sure I won't be masturbating anymore. But I found this is a lot more difficult than anything else. I have very addictive personality, and I found this is by far the most difficult thing I'm dealing with. I've been in the program for 3 years, and I'm about 2 weeks sober. I have relapsed maybe a dozen times during these three years. But what I know is today, what I know is I don't lie, I don't steal, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't cheat on any longer. I'm a totally different person than I used to be 6 years ago. So I've come a long way, but still I do relapse. And so God brought me to Nashville, you know, said, get on the plane and go to international meeting. This is a good place to go. And I thought, well, you have 10 days. You have 2 weeks sober. What are you going to go to an international meeting for when your guru is sitting there for long-time sobriety? And so I haven't spoken in this meeting at all. But this topic, I do deserve to talk. because I can talk about slipping. It's my life has changed tremendously. It really has. I like math, and one thing I did was I added the number of times I masturbated, and I just averaged 3 days a week since I was 7 years old. It comes to more than 42,000 times. And if you put half an hour for each instance, that adds up to 3 years and something, constantly, continuously. These are big numbers. And I'm not even adding up all the efforts I'm putting into meeting with others, all the dates that I went on, all the people that I was with. I'm not even adding those. And so I am grateful to be here. I am by far a totally different person I was 5, 6 years ago. And I'm going to keep coming back to this meeting. Thank you.
We've had reminders during the course of this evening that lust is indeed cunning, baffling, and powerful. But if we maintain our awareness, live and work this program, we also have a solution. So thank you to everybody who shared. Again, for anyone who's interested, that article on relapse prevention plans is up here from the essay. And now if you'd all join me in the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Keep coming back. It works if you work it, so work it. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Larry.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Andrew.
I really appreciate that. It was an answer to prayer for me because I'm realizing like I really need a lot more enthusiasm and seriousness about sobriety. I'm like, oh, 60% want to be sober in 3 or 4 months, which is crazy.
Yeah, it won't work.
It was helped a lot.
Yeah,
I'm
glad. Okay, keep working the program. All right. Next to you, Alan.
My question is that some of the other talks, people were saying, well, you know, if you're slipping, you know, every 2 months, 6 months, 8 months, then that's not really sobriety. But yet people are saying that they are changing their lives. So
yeah.
What is it?
That debate goes on. I'm not part of the debating society. I know that if we're making progressive lust, if we're obtaining sobriety, we fall and we get back up. We don't let someone keep us down by saying, yeah, you're not sober. We say, I want sobriety, I'm getting back on my feet, and I'm doing the work. If we slip again, we look at where am I messing up, you know, and we get back.
So you learn,
and
so it's
work.
Like a progressive.
Yeah.
And I know for me, every time I slip, I've had a lot of sobriety before, so I'm in a different place anyway.
Yeah, that's it. We don't give up. We don't quit. You know, we don't quit. Okay? Good. So don't quit, okay? Very good.
Hey, how are you? Hey, I'm Josh.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Gainesville, Florida. We only have one person.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of the leader or whatever. I've been there for quite a while. I'm just talking with folks. After me, I know you got a little guitar on you.
Yeah, right. I don't play, though.
No, actually, I do play. Yeah, I do. I love music. But could I get your name and number?
Yeah. It's
actually.
My email is number 2. But, okay. But there's an email address.
Uh-huh.
And my phone would be 562-320-5212. Thank you.
563-320-5212. I've got about 14 months of sobriety. I've been in the program for like 12 years.
Yeah.
I've had 3 years. I've lost it after 3 years, basically by moving and not doing the program anymore, trying to do it on my own. I'm just trying to connect and talk to people.
I'm glad you did, because it's easy to get.
I know. And I've got a bunch of numbers. I'm trying to get an